how could Shimon Again, you understand, this is not the same kasha we talked about, how could Yaakov marry two sisters. This is a much more difficult kasha. So Yaakov marrying two sisters is based on the teaching that even though the Torah wasn't given yet, the Jews kept the Torah before it was given. But the Maharal points out, okay, that's what they normally did, but since they didn't have to do that, if there were important reasons, they could modify it. Because it wasn't, that thing wasn't mandatory. You see, so that's a whole other type of thing. But here, if you're dealing with a violation of the Noahide law, that is their absolute obligation. There's no wiggle room for something like that. So here, I have to go to Gemara and Brachos and something that Rashi brings as well. Rashi brings a Medrash that says that when Leah was pregnant with her last, when Rachel was pregnant with her child, that child was actually supposed to be a girl. And when Leah was pregnant with a child, that would have been a boy, that would have been the boy that would have become Yosef. Leah knew with Ruach HaKodesh that there's only going to be 12 tribes. And if she has the 11th, and if she gives birth to a boy, what is going to happen is that will only leave one shape for Rachel to have. And that would make Rachel inferior to even the maidservant, each of whom had two. So Leah prayed that what she should carry should be a girl, and what Rachel carries is a boy. And that is why Leah had Dinah, and that is why Rachel had Yosef, because of Leah's prayer. So Leah gave up a shape. Now, Rashi does not explain how this thing happened. But Targum Yonasan Ben Uziel says, amazingly enough, it was an embryo switch. Targum Yonasan Ben Uziel actually says that Leah was carrying a male embryo, Yosef. Rachel was carrying a female embryo, Dinah. And God did surgery. Pulled the male, put it into Rachel, took the female, put it into Leah. Now, Rashi doesn't say it worked that way, but Targum Yonasan adds the idea, Yischalfu Ubrayim. It turns out, therefore, that genetically, Yosef was Leah's child. Genetically, Yosef was conceived from Leah's egg, and Dinah was conceived from Rachel's egg that got fertilized. But Rachel became the birth mother of Yosef. Now, the reason why this is extremely fascinating is the following. Contemporary medical practice. One of the fertility technologies that we have, it's amazing how these drugs could manage and be so directly relevant, is for people who cannot have children, we have something called surrogate mothers, or we have egg donation, which is really just reverse. Surrogate mother would be, let's say you have a husband and a wife, and the woman ovulates, and her egg can be fertilized in vitro, but let's say she's not able to carry a baby. So in the secular world out there, there's actually a business where some women say they agree to carry the baby for 9 months and then give it up. Called rent a womb, surrogate mother, whatever. Aim hunda koit. Now, halakhically, it should not be done at all, but the question I'm asking is not, are you allowed to do it? But the question is this, what is the status of the child if the source of the egg is a Jewish woman and the aim kundatait is a non-Jewish woman? Do I define, in other words, yes, Judaism is defined by the mother, to be sure, but the question becomes, who's the mother? Is it the birth mother or is it the genetic origin? So it's a machlokes. Some postscripts say you look at the birth mother, so if the birth mother is a good, child needs conversion. Others say you look at the egg donor, the egg mother. So if the egg mother is Jewish, you don't, or vice versa. Now, the same thing is by egg donation, which could work this way. Egg donation, which is much more common, is simply a reverse scenario where, let's say, a woman, a husband and a wife, so the woman could carry a baby, but she's not ovulating, she's not producing egg. So here, a woman donates an egg, it gets fertilized by the husband and sperm, then it goes into his wife. So it's going to be the same halacha in Shaila. Do you look at the genetic donor, or do you look at the birth mother? In other words, it's just a reversal. So again, there are different shittas. I don't want to get into all the shittas right now, but all I'm saying is that based on Targum Yonasan, we might have a proof that you look at the genetic origin, because according to Targum Yonasan, Dina was genetically Rachel's child, and Yosef was genetically Leah's child. But the birth mother of Dina was Leah. Now, if Shimon marries Dina, Shimon would not be allowed to marry Dina if they shared a mother. So we have to assume they didn't share a mother. But how could that be? Leah was Shimon's mother, and Leah was Dina's mother. Answer? Maybe Leah was not halachically Shimon's mother. Maybe Rachel was halachically Shimon's mother, because genetically, Rachel's egg was the one out of whom Shimon came. I'm sorry, out of whom Dina came. And if that's the case, that's why the man always is that Shimon and Dina only shared a father, they didn't share a mother halachically. And that is why Shimon would be allowed to marry Dina. Now, it turns out, therefore, according to that, by a non-Jewish Ein Punda Kait, it would now come to the conclusion that the child would not need a conversion, if you follow the language of this Medrash. Conversely, an egg donor by a non-Jew, that is in a Jewish woman's womb, would need a conversion. La halacha l'maisa, absolutely do not pasca, of course I'm already saying that you cannot derive halachas from midrashim. Midrashim have symbolic meanings, midrashim have non-literal meanings sometimes, and midrashim are not intended to give you halachic rules. So we absolutely do not derive any halacha from midrashim, but it's fascinating that it would have a bearing on that particular question. Did someone have a question?
Yeah. Why can't we just say that Shimon did an avera? How do we know that he didn't maybe do something that was prohibited?
Well, it's possible, but once again, the issue becomes, why isn't Shimon rebuked? I mean, we know that when the Shvatim do bad things, like killing Shechem,
right,
you know, Yaakov rebukes them and the like. We know that when Reuven, it says he slept with his father's maidservant Bilhah, and Chazal say that he didn't really do that. He just went. When Rachel died, he moved the bed from Bilhah's tent to Leah's tent. And that's called interfering with his father's marital relationship. So it wasn't even, it was not adultery or anything like that. And yet the Torah is very harsh. And Yaakov curses Reuven for doing that. So if Shimon would be committing an act of incest of that nature, the assumption is the Torah would at least record it as a sin, as it records other sins. So our assumption is there was nothing wrong with it. And either event, why don't Chazal say something's wrong with it? Right. And the point is, Chazal record the fact, and they don't say anything wrong about it. So even if it's not a kasha on Shimon per se, I think it's a kasha on Chazal. What were Chazal thinking? Why didn't Chazal say there was something wrong with it? So again, this is a bit of a roundabout teretz, but it's fascinating that there is a relevance in these midrashim to modern again, I'm not at all telling you that any of this is permissible. We're just dealing with after the fact. If it is done, this is how rabbis have to deal with. We are confronted with the status of these kids. Are these kids Jewish? Are these kids non-Jewish? What do you do? And this is a big shaila that one has to confront. Now, surrogacy is much rarer than egg donation, but egg donation is fairly common even within the frum community. And in the United States, Kimat always, the egg donors are non-Jewish, so you're going to have this question about conversion. If they're Jewish, you have not a conversion question, But you do have a question, which relatives? You know, it's important to know who your mother is, because that determines who are your siblings in terms of who you can marry and everything else. Okay. All right, so now we go back. So after Yosef is sold to Potiphar, we then read the very unusual story of Yehuda and Tamar. And again, how does this start off? Again, we'll probably have to save this for tomorrow. But this is really the story of the roots of Mashiach. It's a very, very important idea. And Yehuda marries a Canaanite woman. Yehuda has three sons from the Canaanite woman, Er, Onan, and Sheva. He takes a wife for his son Er, and the name of this woman is Tamar. Now it's interesting that Rashi brings the Chazal that Tamar is not just a local Canaanite. Tamar, in fact, is a very, very distinguished lineage. Tamar is actually the daughter of Shem. Now, it probably cannot be the direct daughter of Shem. Shem would have been hundreds of years old by now. So how old could Tamar be? But she was a descendant of Shem, so actually she was in the family. You want to say?
I'm just curious. How is a Canaanite okay for Yehuda when it's specifically stated that they're not okay for like Yitzhak or like marry a Canaanite?
Right. So I mentioned a little earlier that the way this works, the way it was understood, is that when Am Yisrael was very small, when they were just beginning, they did not want to take local non-Jews, because the fear would be that the smaller group would be assimilated into the larger group and they would lose their connection to Hashem. But as the mishpacha gets bigger, and now you have approaching 70 people, although you don't have quite that yet, at this point, they felt they were a strong enough unit that if they found a God-fearing, righteous Canaanite, again, God-fearing, righteous, they could bring him into their family and they would not be pulled into interaction with the negative family. So the idea of not marrying a Canaanite was not an absolute prohibition. It was a self-imposed limit at a time when Am Yisrael was a very, very small and vulnerable to being part of a larger godless unit. And that's why I mentioned, it's not just Yehuda, according to one Medrash, all the Shvatim married Canaanite, right? The Machlokes and Rashi. Who did the tribes marry? Rashi, one opinion is the twin sister. The other opinion is they married Canaanite women. And so, according to that, your question would not only be on Yehuda, your question would be on everybody. And the answer has to be that by the time we got to the Shvatim, the concern was much less. Keep in mind that although we don't have exact numbers, the unit that is called Am Yisrael is not just Yaakov's children. They also have Gerim, they have slaves, they have a lot of people who are part of their group. So there may be several hundred, maybe hundreds and hundreds of people. So as a result, they're a self-contained, spiritually strong unit in which they could take in the God-fearing Canaanite and they could become part of Am Yisrael, as opposed to the early years. That's what the Baral seems to say. Okay, but Yehuda didn't want a Canaanite, or at least he went beyond the Canaanite and he actually picked the daughter or the descendant of Shem, a very, very righteous woman, and he marries her off to his son Er. The Torah then says, very enigmatically, that Er did evil in the eyes of God, and God killed him. Now, it's not clear what is the evil that Er did. We'll come back to this. And Yehuda then told Onan, go and marry your brother's wife. And this is the very first word, Yabei Mosa. And that way, you will perpetuate his seed. Now, Ramban points out that we know in the Torah there is a commandment that applies to this very day, that when a man dies without children, there is a mitzvah on his brother to marry the widow, but if the widow doesn't want or the brother doesn't want, there's a ceremony called chalitza where she pulls off his shoe and she spits in front of him, not in his face, in front of him. And she says, so shall be done to the man who does not want to rebuild his brother's home. But it's clear in the Torah that it's a little odd. It's very clear in the Torah that Yibum is what you're supposed to do. But if you don't want to, well, you have Chalitza. And a woman cannot marry anybody else if she gets Chalitza. Today, in case you want to know the halacha of Maisa, today we actually do not, well, Ashkenazim at least, Ashkenazim do not practice Yibum. And the reason that's given is based on the Gemara that says that Yibum is actually incestuous, but when you do it for the mitzvah, it's permitted. And since today we're not sure if our kavanah is going to be pure, we are supposed to avoid Yibum, even if you wanted to do Yibum. Even if I wanted to do Yibum, I'm not allowed to today, based on Ashkenazim. And that's why the only thing you have is chalitza. Right? A woman still needs chalitza. She cannot marry without chalitza. But the Ramban points out that Yibum pre-existed the giving of the Torah. That somehow people understood intuitively that a brother can perpetuate the neshama. And that is why Onan was told to do Yibum. And Onan did. But look what it says. That says, Onan knew that the child would not be his. And he spilled his seed in order that Tamar should not get pregnant. What's the concept? There was a concept that the child that is born out of Yibum, let's say you're the young, is not your child. The child that is born out of Yibum is the child of the dead man. It is the dead man's neshama that enters the child, not really your neshama, not part of your spiritual essence, although obviously brothers share a common spiritual essence. But essentially, the child of Yibum is the child of the mess. Now, halachically, that doesn't have any major implication. Halachically, in terms of inheritance rights and the like, the Yibum's child is the same as, you know, the child from Yibum is the same as any other kids he would have. But spiritually, Onan felt, this is not going to be my kid. This is going to be my dead brother's kid. I don't want to have a kid that's not mine. Kind of possession question. None of our children are ours, really. But Onan had a certain possessiveness. So his sin is a very serious sin. His sin is what we call the spilling of seed in vain. Hashchasas zera. In modern parlance, this would include, you know, masturbation. This would include intercourse with a condom. Whether different contraception devices may not be hashchasas zera if they don't interfere with the physical act of intercourse. So if a woman takes a birth control pill, that is not hashchasas zera because even though there's no pregnancy, but the bia is kedarka. But he literally was mashkas the zera. He interrupted the tashmish and was mashkas the zera. Therefore, God killed him. And this is where we get the English phrase, really, from the Greek, onanism, which is an older, archaic term for hashchas zera. Now, what's interesting is, the Torah tells me what Onan did. And Onan died for this. God killed him. But the Torah does not tell me what Er did. It says Er did evil in the eyes of God. But it does not say what Er did. So the truth of the matter is, the psukim are not at all clear, but Chazal seem to have understood that Er did the same thing as Onan. And in fact, the sin is described as the sin of Er and Onan. But what was Er's motivation? Onan's motivation was he didn't want to have a kid that belonged to Er. But what's Er's motivation? The kid that Er has will be Er's kid. So Rashi explains that Tamar was so beautiful, he did not want to mar Tamar's beauty by getting her pregnant. There'd be other wives. People had other wives they could have been pregnant. One wife for beauty. Right? So they had two different motivations, right? So the common denominator was both of them were mashkas zera, which is a very serious sin. Er did it because he wanted to preserve his wife's physical beauty. And Onan did it because he didn't want to have a child that belonged spiritually to another person. Didn't want, he didn't want. So they both died. So now, there's only one brother left. And that one brother is Shelah. It's Shelah's turn to do evil.
I thought if the second brother dies, she's considered a murderous wife. And
okay,
you're not
so
supposed
that's,
to do
yeah, so that's, this is actually the discussion here. So the discussion here is, so it mentions Yehuda, and this story is the source of these rules. Yehuda did not want to give Tamar to his third son, because Yehuda felt that there was a problem that two of his boys died shortly after they married Tamar. He was afraid that she is what we call halakhically katlanis. Katlanis is a killing wife. Again, this is not assuming she's a murderer. I mean, that's not the issue here. But there's some mazel or some, you know, connection. There actually is a rule that if a woman had several husbands died, so my focus is two husbands or three husbands. So Yehuda was afraid. Now again, the Chumash does not indicate Yehuda was acting because of halacha. We'll talk about this. But Yehuda was afraid that she would kill, you know, indirectly, she would somehow kill Shelah. So he made up an excuse. He said, we'll just wait until Shelah gets a little older. How old was Shelah? We're not even sure. But Yehuda had no intention to allow this marriage. Now, one question is, I mean, in a way, Yehuda's behavior is very, very difficult to understand. Because Mimanafshes. What happens is Tamar gets pregnant, and she gets pregnant from Yehuda. But putting aside that part of the story, which we'll talk about tomorrow, Yehuda now sentences her for adultery because she's supposed to be connected to Shelah. I mean, how can Yehuda have it both ways? Putting aside, this is, you know, let's say she was residing with somebody else, not Yehuda. Okay, so I want to factor out that part of the story. If Yehuda maintains that she is connected to Shelah, then let Shelah marry her. If Yehuda maintains that, well, Shelah can't marry her because she's a dangerous wife, then release her. What is the justification to hold Tamar as being connected to the third son? If Yehuda, I mean, what would be the equivalent? Again, we don't know what the ceremony would have been, but just like the Torah says, right? The Torah says later that if I don't want to be miyaveh, I must release the woman with chalitza. In other words, you can't just say, I don't want to be miyaveh, but you're stuck to me. Can't do that. You either do yibum or you do chalitza. By the way, she also has a yibum, meaning if I want to do yibum and she doesn't, there's no yibum. Yibum has to be mutual consent. So what's going on with Yehuda here? If Yehuda does not want her to marry Shelah, then give her, again, I don't know what the ceremony is. We don't really know what the ceremony of release would have been, but there ought to be a ceremony of release. Right? So that's a very difficult kashya. Now, one simple answer might be, well, how much time left? Maybe Yehuda would have given her a release, but she was mazana before the release. In other words, it's not that Yehuda was holding her hostage for years. Maybe he was going to give her a release tomorrow, but in the meantime, you know, they had that encounter. I mean, that might be one way of understanding it. But of course, there's so many things that are difficult here. Number one, why is there a death penalty? I mean, if a woman is a Yavama, and she's mazana with a man before chalitza, that's not a death penalty. That is not halachic adultery. That's a violation called Yavama Lashuk. A Yavama who lives with a guy other than the Yavan before chalitza is transgressing a negative commandment. But certainly it's not adultery. So why would Tamar be put to death because she was with another man? And second of all, she doesn't get put to death because she happened to be with her father-in-law. Well, doesn't that make it worse instead of making it better? Not only was she with another man, she was with her father-in-law. That would make it a bigger aveira, not a lesser aveira. So the whole thing is fair. Number one, why doesn't Yehuda release her? Right? Or get Shelah to release her. Number two, even if she was with another man, why would she be deserving of death? And number three, if she is deserving of death, why, if she was with Yehuda, would that somehow exonerate her? If anything, they both should be put to death. Put her to death and put him to death, too, as the adulterer. Okay, so we'll talk about this tomorrow.